Jim McDivitt, Colonel, United States Air Force, Commander of Apollo 9. You have a lot of responsibility, Jim, and you've been training a long, long time for it. We think you have a good crew. How do you feel now that the show is about to get on the road?
Well, I'm pretty happy about it. Like you say, we've been training a long time, and nobody likes to spend that much time for nothing. We had a mission. We've had it for a long time. It's stayed pretty much the same, and I'm glad to see the days to launch becoming fewer and fewer, and it looks like it's, well, it actually is within sight now.
As the final minutes of launch approach, what will you be doing there in the command module? What are the first things you do there, right?
The last couple of minutes before launch?
Yes.
Oh, we'll be configuring the spacecraft for its initial flight into space. We have to turn off some of the water glycol valves and configure it so that we have the right kind of cooling during launch. Then we check some of the instruments that tell us that the booster and spacecraft are both go during the launch phase.
Gradual transfer of power from the outside to the inside?
That's right. A lot of it is done automatically, but we have to do a little bit inside the spacecraft, and we'll be going on with that. And then I guess I'll just be going over in my mind the things that, the different options that I have during launch. If all goes well, there's very little that we have to do. What we really have to be prepared for are contingencies, and I'll have to go over in my mind those different options that we have.
Mm-hmm. And at liftoff, what is the command module's function? What do the command module pilot and the commander at liftoff? What is the commander's function?
Well, really nothing if everything goes right. During the whole launch, we're sort of passive if the vehicle is performing the way it should. If the vehicle does not perform the way it should, then we have to take a number of actions that either configure the spacecraft so that it's go for orbit or to, and in this case, I hope this never happens, but we have to be able to abort from the booster if something happens to the booster. We really have to make the decision to get off the booster or stay with it. And if we ever have to decide to get off, then we have to make the decision what to do after that. There are a number of different and distinct modes of abort during launch. Mode 1A, B, C, mode 2, 3, and 4. And as we change our altitude and velocity during launch, we enter and exit each one of these abort modes so that we have to be prepared to do that type of abort if necessary. Hopefully we won't do that, so what we'll really be trying to do is continue to configure the spacecraft so that it can get into orbit.
We usually hear very little from you three pilots during a liftoff. That's because you're all very busy watching instruments, isn't it? And just reading off or calling back certain planned signals.
That's right. There are a lot of things that happen in the spacecraft, and we sort of use a method of negative reporting for most of them. If they occur on time, we don't say anything. If something occurs abnormally, then we do call it out. However, to assure that there is communications between a spacecraft and the ground, we make discrete calls roughly every minute during the launch phase. There are some other calls that have to be made at certain times to let the ground know that an event has occurred because it changes significantly the things that we would do. But there are very few of these, so that during the launch, which lasts roughly 11 minutes, we would expect a call to the ground probably 15 or 20 times at the most.
Mm-hmm. So we shouldn't worry about it if we're not hearing from
you. No. It's a lot easier to concentrate on what you're doing if you don't have to make a lot of unnecessary reports. And quite often you have to be monitoring one part of the instrument panel and then another part. And there is a lot of talking that goes on in the spacecraft between the pilots. During the launch, the command module pilot is monitoring the trajectory as displayed from our own onboard computers. And he's telling me how it's going, and I'm monitoring the dynamic response of the launch vehicle. And so we're using that information together to decide how things are.
Thank you very much, Jim McDivitt.
You're welcome.
Okay, I guess we're back. I guess we're down to earth enough to.
I think I have a martini here.
Okay, ready? Jim McDivitt, you've flown before in Gemini 4 with astronaut Ed White. Would you tell us just a bit about your flying career and what you've been doing since Gemini 4? First of all, when did you start flying at all? You were in the Air Force.
Well, my first flight was in an airplane was after I got into the Air Force, and it was back in 1951. Since then, I guess I've had... Not a normal Air Force career. It was it was pretty normal up till about 1959 or so, and then I went through the experimental test pilot school out at Edwards Air Force Base and been acting as a test pilot ever since then.
So you were one of the second group of astronauts to be assigned to NASA, and most of you came from the test pilot ranks, as I recall.
That's correct. There are a number of Air Force and Navy test pilots in our program, and I think in that second group, I think they all were.
Mm-hmm.
There are some civilian test pilots, too. I shouldn't slight them, and also Marines. I want to make sure we give fair credit to everyone.
If my arithmetic is anywhere near correct, you have something over 4,000 hours in the air now, just flying airplanes. Is that right?
Well,
or do you keep track of it?
Back when I had 500 and 600 hours, I used to keep track of it pretty closely. But now that I... I have over 4,000, but I couldn't tell you how much.
Mm-hmm.
It's somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000, but much closer to 4,000.
I'll bet you know how much time you have in space in Gemini 4.
Uh-oh, an embarrassing question. I think it's a little less than 100 hours. It was a little bit less than 4 days, or maybe a little bit over 4 days. So it's about 90-some hours.
You're from Michigan originally?
No, I was born in Chicago, but my parents live in Michigan now, and we moved there in 1942 and have lived in Michigan since 1942.
What was your educational background before you went into the Air Force?
Well, I went to Jackson Junior College, which has since been expanded to the Jackson Community College in Jackson, Michigan, and I had 2 years there. I joined the Air Force and went through pilot training during the Korean War. After the war was over, I went back to school under the Air Force's educational program to the University of Michigan. I graduated from there in 1959.
You have a few honorary doctorates, too, since that Gemini 4 flight, haven't you?
Oh, just one. But from my own school. And
from your alma mater?
That's right, from the University of Michigan. It makes me very proud.
Mm-hmm. What impresses you most? When you back way off and think about this flight in Apollo 9, what's the single thought that hangs with you most closely, other than doing a good job?
Well, that's the single thought. Now you want one besides the single thought.
I'm assuming that, since I know you're conscientious.
Well, it's really hard to say. I think that the doing the good job is really utmost in my mind. I think that to get people to work the kind of hours that we all work, and I don't mean just the pilots, I mean the people that support me, either directly on my flight crew support team, or the people that work for the good of our mission in the flight control division, and all those people in the engineering development division within NASA, the contractors and everything, to work the way they do means that they all really feel that the goal of getting to the moon is a worthwhile thing. And I'm just pretty happy to be playing my little part in getting us there. Of course, we're not there, and I hesitate to see everybody feel that it's going to be automatic because we've had a couple successes. I think we still have a long ways to go, and I hope that our flight contributes something to the knowledge of the ease or difficulty of getting there.
Thank you very much, Jim McDivitt. All right. Now go into flight stuff here. Just in these little blurbs will be dropped in.
I know, you just can't keep your mind concentrating anything longer than a couple minutes.
Me or
you.
Anybody?
Isn't that right, Riley?
Need a little more training discipline here. Jim, what is it like to have to learn to fly two spacecraft for one mission? You're going to be piloting both a lunar module and a command and service module on Apollo 9.
Well, I used to think that it would be two times as hard as flying one vehicle, but I found out that it's a lot more than two times as hard. It's like 10 times harder. It just seems that the two vehicles are so complex that you learn one, and then you start on the other one, and by the time you've really gone through it, you've sort of forgotten the things you learned in the first one, and it's a never-ending circle to just stay up to date with all the systems of the two vehicles. And then when we discuss the operations, we fly in so many different configurations. Command and service module only, command module only, command and service module dock with the lunar module ascent and descent stages together, lunar module ascent stage only, command and service module dock with the ascent stage only, all of this on the S-4B. We have so many combinations that it's really a spectrum of flight that we're going through, certainly flight vehicles that we're going through.
You've amplified the observation that came from Apollo Program Manager General Sam Phillips a few weeks ago, in which he said Apollo 9 is a much more complex mission than the previous Apollo manned flights. I'm sure you must agree with that, then.
Well, I don't think it's fair to compare one mission with another mission.
Well, you have the extra spacecraft, of course.
Well, that's true. I think that each mission has its own little niche to fill. It's a little sort of a cog in the big wheel that's going to roll us onto the moon. It's certainly the most complex mission I've flown, and I can say that because I can compare one to another. I think each mission has its own milestone, and we have ours, and we're going to try to take care of it.
You and Dave Scott and Rusty Schweikert have joked with us about the complexity of the mission and the intricate training you've gone through and the many things you still have to learn. How do you really feel about it at this point in time?
Well, there's an awful lot before each mission, and I think that we're going to have to get it all done, and I think that everybody knows that they're not going to launch us until we're prepared. When we go, we'll be ready. We're never going to be as ready as we'd like to be. You know, you could train for a mission forever and never really be satisfied that you knew every intricate detail. But I don't think it's necessary to know the minutest detail. We have a wonderful team on the ground that can fill in the details.
That's what I was coming to next, is you do have extensive support from the Mission Control Center and from all over the Earth where you'll be orbiting.
That's right. We have a number of NASA flight controllers in the Mission Control Center, and they're supported by the contractors who have designed and built our equipment. And if we need to know something about it in flight, we're certainly going to get the best advice that we can possibly get.
Thank you very much, Jim McDivitt. Okay, let's see.
You got a squeak.
What the devil is
yeah,
that?
Yeah, must be something in the air conditioning fan.
It sounds like the squirrel cages.
Mine at home does the same thing.
It never works to get Riley to send one of these over to the your office. They never come back. That's the only one I could find.
Hey, I tell you, if there's anything over there for me to sign, I haven't signed it because I haven't been around lately.
You know, I've already forgotten to get the other two guys when they're here. This is the only picture they've got, apparently, in there.
No, we have some new ones.
New? Is there a better one than this?
Yeah.
I hate this old
We have some new ones in white suits that we just came out this week, I guess. I hadn't seen them until I came home last night. My wife had one. You know, I always learn about the space program from my wife.
Now, I really need all I can get on the rendezvous. Let's stop a second. Let me get geared here with him on how we're going to organize this. Jim, I believe that the most crucial and one of the most interesting aspects of your flight will be that rendezvous day when you and Rusty Schweikert will be in the LEM, the lunar module, separating away from the ship, which can get you back to Earth. That, number one, is important, isn't it?
Yes, and by the way, that ship will get us back to Earth. Not can, but will get us back to Earth.
Okay. Tell me what you will be doing there during the early separation parts of this maneuver, this all-day maneuver.
Okay. Early, we check out the spacecraft. We do this while we're docked to the other vehicle. But there's only a limit to what we can do. So we'll undock, fly around the command module while he observes the different parts of our spacecraft from his spacecraft. And then we'll separate only out to 3 or 4 miles to make sure that everything is operating properly. If it's not, we'll be able to come right back in. If all is going well, we'll configure the spacecraft to do what we call a phasing maneuver, where we will fire the descent propulsion system. We will have checked out the radar in the beginning. We will check out the alignment of our inertial platform by looking at stars through a telescope. When we've confirmed that these things are okay, we'll go ahead and make this maneuver, which we call phasing. It'll be done on our descent propulsion system. We'll actually use our abort guidance system, which is a backup computer and flight control system, to guide during this particular time to evaluate that system. After we lit the engine up, we'll start out in a very large circle that's sort of shaped like a football, and we'll be referring to these things during the flight as footballs. The little maneuver we make is what we call the mini football, and the larger one, where we'll go out to about 50 miles, we call the maxi football.
I assure you, my associates and I are spending a lot of time explaining that.
We're really not playing football, we're playing rendezvous. As we go out, we'll evaluate the spacecraft again. Now at a longer range, we'll be able to look at our radar and how it performs at long ranges. If it's going well and the rest of the spacecraft is performing as it should, we'll come down to the bottom of our football and receive a go from the ground to continue our separation out to 100 miles. As we pass back close to the command module, probably 3 or 4 miles away, We'll be tracking him with our radar. He'll be observing us to see that everything is okay. Then we'll come up to the top of our football and light our engine again. This maneuver is called the insertion maneuver, and once again we'll be using the descent propulsion system, but throttled down to its minimum throttle so that it's more easily controlled and can put us in a precise orbit.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of this throttleable engine, say that word for me.
Throttleable.
We're all going to have a lot of trouble with that, too.
That's right. Well, fortunately, there aren't very many throttleable rocket engines. There are very few, and we have one of them.
Okay, thanks, Jim. And we'll see you when you begin that rendezvous braking maneuver.
Roger.
The second part of the rendezvous exercise is concerned with maneuvers which bring you back to the command module, in which Dave Scott is watching you all along. Would you summarize what you're doing at that time, Jim?
Certainly. We've gone through some earlier maneuvers that have put us on a trajectory that causes us to increase our range from the command module, and we'll go out to a range of approximately 100 miles. As we're doing this, we'll go through three distinct maneuvers which will cause us to return to the command module. They have letters CSI, CDH, and TPI. The significance of the letters really doesn't amount to much, except that...
They're engineering terms.
They're engineering terms, that's right. What they really mean is that the first maneuver will cause us to come to an orbit which will be shaped exactly like our target vehicle, the command module, but will cause us to be about 10 miles below them and flying along at the same constant altitude difference of about 10 miles. When we get down to the bottom where we are 10 miles, we'll fire the engine again so that we'll stay at the 10 miles. And then as we come in, we'll do another maneuver called TPI, which will cause us to come up from the bottom, change our 10-mile altitude to zero, and we'll come up in sort of a fishhook-shaped maneuver, which will bring us from behind and below to a point that's slightly in front and equal altitude with them and close to a range of 25 or so feet before we start our docking maneuver.
Mm-hmm.
One of the interesting things with this particular rendezvous is that our target vehicle, the command module, is really more than just a target vehicle. It's a dynamic vehicle, and although we don't normally plan on him doing anything, he's always prepared to make the maneuver if we can't. So the one man in the command module is responsible for operating that whole vehicle, calculating all the maneuvers that we do, and prepared. It has to be prepared to back up our maneuver. So if we find out that one of our engines won't work, he can fire his engine a minute after we should have fired ours, and we stay in the same relative position. So this particular relative motion that we have always remains constant, regardless of whether the LEM has a problem or not.
Are you getting as much information from the ground, from mission control, as is the command module during this period?
Well, actually, we receive the same information. Because we have a very difficult time of coordinating communications between the lunar module, the command module, and the ground, we worked out a procedure where the ground sends information to the lunar module. The command module copies it down, and we copy it down, and then by applying some constant biases of a minute, a few feet per second, he can work out the maneuver that he should do, and then he does that one if we can't do our own.
Is all of this, does all of this go into your computers?
Yes, indeed. The command module has one computer, and the lunar module has two computers. We have radar that we can use the radar information with some charts so that we can actually figure out the rendezvous with a set of charts and some paper and pencil.
Mm-hmm.
However, it's not nearly as convenient as using the computers, and we much prefer the computers.
Thanks very much, Jim McDivitt, for explaining all that to us. Jim, how dangerous do you consider the overall Apollo 9 mission?
Well, I never think about the danger of the thing. I think about what we're going to accomplish. I think that anything we do has some danger to it, and I don't feel that you probably worry too much about driving to work in the morning, but you know, a lot of people don't make it when they start out. I think danger is just a mental, or the thought of danger is a mental attitude, and I think different people approach it differently. The little old lady from Pasadena that everybody talks about, it would hardly be mentally and morally prepared, I think, to leap into a high-speed airplane and fly across the country. I think it's the kind of mental attitude that you've developed throughout your life. I hope my mental attitude has been developed such that I don't really worry that much about the flight.
Good luck on the whole mission, Jim.
Thank you.
Jim McDivitt, commander of Apollo 9. Period.
Beep, beep, beep. Is that about it?
That's about
it. Where are we supposed to hit it?
Well, you got a couple of minutes. your clock is slow.
Clock is slow.
I don't know. It's I thought it was way fast.
What do you got? What do you have?
I've got 27 inches.
So what?
Okay. You used up 3 minutes just clearing your throat.
Luck to you.
Thank you. I see you again.
Okay. Hope to see you when you get back.